This is the point where we usually say, if you have a story about a journey, change, crossroads, we're interested. So we're going to say it. Do that. Email us at info@hitching.org or go through the website and drop us a line about it.
One might ask, well, here is a truly diverse spectrum of humanity. Is there any common thread here other than the fact that they happen to be past 80? The one thing I see in common is a certain sense of license, being able to speak absolutely without pretense or consideration of what anybody else is going to think.
Although our next guy has been doing that for at least the 40 years that we've known him. Here is Leon Katz.
Leon Katz is in his 80s. He's taught literature at leading universities. He's written many plays. He's mesmerized generations of students, myself included. He's had a well-traveled life, but he talks very little about himself. His deepest journeys have been into literature.
I trusted it. I trusted it as I trusted nothing else. I trusted the truth of the journey recorded in literature as I trusted nothing else, because it is possible with a book in front of you to become an observer equal in strength at the moment to the text of the book itself. Whereas in life, you cannot do exactly the same thing. You can be overwhelmed by the force and the power of an opponent. And when you're reading a book, you're under none of those constraints. You see, you're free. You're really in a situation so that your mind can operate directly on the text and think, is this true? Is this not true? Is this for me? Is it not for me? And so on. I remember reading in a lovely book called The Faith of Our Fathers about Jewish immigrants coming to this country. He describes a mother, I don't know if this is his own mother, but a mother taking her child to the library and saying, all right, now you have a library card, now read. It struck me because that's exactly the experience I went through at the age of 5. When my mother took me to the library, I read haltingly the words that made it possible for me to get the library card, and then she said, now you have a library card, now read. And that was open sesame for me, as it was for my whole generation. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment, and I remember that vividly. And I thought, oh, all this is mine. But most of my journeys have been toward disillusion rather than toward what we think of as positive. I think disillusion is positive myself. But I found that, for example, on the question of religion, I got over that at the age of 7. I was in Hebrew school. And I remember that we got to Moses and the burning bush. And one of my colleagues, one of my confreres, raised his hand and asked the rabbi teacher, is this a true story? And he said, well, it's a myth. He said, well, but is that true? He said, well, it's a myth. I thought to myself, oh, it's a myth. And that cleared the question for me forever. It's a myth that's fascinating, and I continue to love the story of the Jewish people, how they came out of Egypt and all that sort of thing. And it delighted me no end, but it never occurred to me again that there was any truth in it whatsoever. Ever. Ever again. And there's a Spanish word for it that I use when I'm teaching Spanish literature. Desengaño. Desengaño. Unillusion. Not disillusion, but unillusion. The scales falling from your eyes when you suddenly see the plain truth. It seems to me that those are the journeys that are most impressive to me, the journeys that are desengaño. And the greatest of them all, I think, is King Lear. But the discovery that King Lear makes at the end of his incredible journey, through terrible disappointment, through terrible disillusion, through terrible madness, and finally a clarification comes at the end. And that clarification is what the world is really made of. And the world is made of anything but the kinds of mythical beliefs that he was filled with at the beginning of the play. It's a horrible image. It's a horrible image of the world. And then desengaño takes on the meaning of disillusion, not just unillusion. The scales fall away from the eyes, to be sure, but then what is left is desperate. And Lear's conclusion, therefore, is get out of it. Leave it all together. We'll stay, he says to his daughter Cordelia, like birds in a gilded cage, watching who's in, who's out, taking upon us the mystery of things, out of the political world, out of the real world altogether, just watching. And of course, Shakespeare adds the ultimate coup de grace when that possibility is removed from him and he has none left at all.
What always struck me about Leon's lectures were, yes, he spoke about styles of literature, but not as a game. These were journeys into the principle of being human.
I love the mission of teaching thing. I really love it. And that's been true from the very day of the teaching. I thought, my God, what an opportunity this is to do good. And I'm still teaching. I tell you what I love to do with the literature. I love to get into the spirit of a work as though I have written it myself. One of the plays I absolutely adore is Claude Dell's Satin Slipper. I did a production of it, I did a version of it, and so on. But it's a very, very great play. Claudel was the most reactionary Catholic the world has ever known. A bitter and a cruel man in every way, ideologically. But he's written this extremely great play, and it's written right out of his own ideology. But it is the idealism of his ideology. It is the pure beauty, the vein of gold within his ideology that he's writing in this play. If I teach that, that's what I'm teaching. I'm not teaching this reactionary. I hope to avoid that in anything that I do. It is not a question of finding the ideal critical posture, and certainly not the ideal political posture from which to teach. The whole point of teaching is that you want a student to become a citizen of the world, not for the world to become simply an aspect of himself that he already is familiar with. So I love teaching de Sade for the same reason, because de Sade himself has a truth in him that is absolutely true, that is really there, it really is so. What he describes of his own sexual intents, his sexual motives, what he describes of his fictional characters and motives and so on, is something that is deep in humanity. So I don't teach it as though this reprehensible human being is this. I teach it as though it is true, you see. And then the counter to that is in everything else that I'm teaching, you see, if you need a counter to that. I don't myself. I think that de Sade it's quite accurate. Teaching is opening doors, not shutting them, you see. that is, of course, the purpose. There were many books, obviously, that had enormous effect on me. I remember going through Victor Hugo and that being the beginning of a romantic, sentimental feeling about the oppression and injustice and so on, and that I've never lost. I mean, you keep that forever. And that's the thing that if you lose that, then you're not even cynical. You're a nonentity. To see things as they are and to see things as they might be, as they ought to be, it's something that you can do simultaneously. And you had better. Without one or the other, I think you're in deep trouble. There's a wonderful anecdote that Shaw tells. He said, once I was sitting in the circus, and there was a woman sitting beside me, who, when we were watching the lion tamer, she said, oh, the courage of that man is unbelievable. And Shaw turned to her and said, madam, that man is not exhibiting courage. What he is exhibiting is the certainty that the lions, who are well-fed, will not hurt him in any way. Consider, on the other hand, my own position sitting here, outside that cage, who is subject to every whim of politics, of religion, and any one of which could come and destroy me at this very moment. Madam, I am the man with courage. I thought that's extraordinarily wise, because he's exactly right. He's exactly right. When you're dealing with a world that, in which you are surrounded by multiple beliefs, every one of which is pushed to its absolute extreme of certainty, you're in real danger, as we now know only too well. However, the reaction to it is not the reaction that I'm suggesting, it's the opposite reaction. Just as the attack on your values comes from a perspective of the absolute, your response to that attack becomes absolute as well. And it's just as evil. There is no difference between the evil of one and the evil of the other. None at all, as a matter of fact. Depending on the power that you have, your virtue can be a great deal more evil. Every single revolution in the 19th and 20th century has ended in something worse, which is a horrible thing to think of. So what is left of all this is, I think, very much what existentialism had in mind. It's not so much that you're living in an absurd universe as you're living in a dreadfully dangerous universe. And under those circumstances, the only thing to do is never to lose that vision that you had in the first place of the ideal of what life could be, the virtue of what life could be, see? Never to lose that ideal and never to suppose for a moment that it's within your grasp. Well, when you consider that, as I have said to my students many times, the 20th century is the most savage century that Western civilization has known. Without question, the most savage of all. It has done more devastating, more terrible, and more horrible things to humanity than almost any other century. Because we have the two things that are necessary to do the most devastating things in the world. We have the technology, and we have the language to justify it. That's what I despise about ideologies, because they simply justify whatever the technology is capable of doing. And frankly, the only value that I really value is the value of human experience. That's it. It's the condition, human condition, the condition of human beings. Their relative comfort, their relative safety, the relative availability of a cultivated life. That's what I think is valuable, and that's all that I think is valuable in history. The rest of it doesn't matter at all.
What about stories of transcendence, achievement, illumination? Where do these fit?
I think they're beautiful. I really do. I think they're absolutely beautiful. And I'm tremendously moved whenever we get to the top of Parnassus. I think they're magnificent, but I will never lose my love for that possibility. I don't think it's possible, but I never lose my love for that possibility. those are redemptive. They're the very things that give one the sense of being human, rather than just being a factor of greed in the world. So it's one thing to think of the Divine Comedy, one thing to think of Milton, one thing to think of Walt Whitman, but every single one of them, their epiphanies are so grounded in the source and the beginning of that journey into the reality, in absolute reality, that you think of that becomes the most admirable kind of shoring up against the ruins, rather than being the sentimental notion that this is reality itself. There's a glee in what I think of as the truth. There's a glee in facing it, in understanding it, in seeing it for what it is. I very strongly believe that this does not lead to desperation, and it does not lead to ultimate cynicism, because I think that cynicism itself is simply the emotional response to idealism. It's an idealism that you cannot realize, that you do not see realized, but it's one that you never lose.
In Los Angeles, we were talking with Leon Katz. And we should announce that Leon has since accepted a teaching post at the University of North Carolina. Another cross country. He's unstoppable.
When he vowed he'd never stay in one place and become part of the furniture, he meant it.
And finally, Adele Hutchins.
In any social movement, there are the headliners, the media superstars, the conference celebrities, the spokespeople for the cause, and then there are the people who get stuff done on a scale that, in the whole context of saving the world, is very small. But they are the people who inch us a little closer toward the goal, and they never get much attention. So we talked to one. Adele Hutchins was a teacher for 20 years. Now she's in her 80s. She lives in a retirement community just outside Washington, D.C. One of her two daughters is Lorraine Hutchins, whom we interviewed a few years back. Lorraine is a writer and workshop leader in the lesbian and bisexual communities. And she said, "You ought to talk to my mom." So we did, about her own activism.
I had a favorite poem by County and I read it when I was about 17, and I was so touched by it. "Once riding in old Baltimore, heart filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he not one whit bigger. I smiled at him, but he stuck out his tongue and called me nigger. I've walked the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. So I was in the Methodist Church in the youth group, and I invited an African-American woman to speak to our white youth group. And everybody thought that was rather shocking. When was this? About 42 or 43. We went to a church in a neighborhood which was not too far from the beginning of integration. And so when we were going to build a new church, people were sort of concerned because, in fact, there was sort of an argument, should we build or not, because black people are going to be moving in. Well, they did move in. And the thing that galvanized our church into action, there was a church nearby who had a mother who wanted a child to enter the Sunday school. And the minister said to the mother, well, don't you think your child would be happier with her own kind? So we had a very small committee. I and my husband and my mother were on it. There were only a few other people on it. And when African Americans moved in the neighborhood, we visited the homes and we invited them to church. So in 1956, the first children started coming to the Sunday school because we had just had this visitation. In that year, 100 white people left. They just went out in droves. And my husband and I stayed until we had a minister that we just couldn't stand. We stayed until 1969. And my aunt was the last white person in the church. She didn't die till she was 93, and she was treasurer. And then we went to another church downtown. It was in a gay neighborhood, DuPont Circle, as everybody knows in Washington, D.C. I was in the group with gay men in which they talked about the fact that they wanted the church to be able to accept gays and lesbians. So I was on the committee that made the reconciling congregation statement, and the Methodist Church, reconciling congregations are the congregations that accept gays and lesbians and bisexual, and now it says transgender. We had hearings, we had classes, we had other groups that came in and tried to change us into the type of congregation which says we welcome gays and lesbians, but you must go through a period of change so that you are changed by Jesus Christ to heterosexual. So after about 5 years of study, and we had both conservative people and liberal and moderate on the committee, it was very, very fair. So I happened to be chairman of the administrative board at the time it was voted on. It was voted on about in October. I started out in about January and wrote letters to everybody on the board and told them I wanted them to be in prayer about it. What was really God's will and purpose for this church? We also studied some Quaker practices. When a person speaks, you don't immediately interrupt or jump in with another argument. You leave a silence period. We ate dinner together, and we had tables. And at each table, we had someone who was gay, someone who was in prayer during the time we were eating, someone who was from the committee. So like if there were 8 people at the table, 3 people would have specific purposes. And I think that helped a lot because a lot of the talking went on before the actual discussion at the board meeting. The vote was for a reconciling congregation, which we have been ever since.
And another story she told about her work with an integrated neighborhood association. Over the years, I have come more and more to value progressive activism that impacts right now. The work it takes to open a single door can be as hard as breaking down a wall. So I asked, what inspired this impulse in you?
This really all has to do with my religious faith. And the Methodist Church had a social creed at that time, which was against any kind of prejudice, but it wasn't necessarily acted out in the churches, but the social creed said that we should accept everybody as equal. I knew from the start that God intends us to be equal and that Jesus taught us to love one another. and his is a gospel of love.
Was it just as easy for you with gays?
No, I had a lot of prejudice against that at first. No, it took years to break that down. And really, what helped me the most, even more than having my daughter, because I think you fight against something in your family that's strange to you, even more than having my daughter first say she's lesbian, then later bisexual, it was getting to know gay men, hearing their stories. And one man who's still one of my best friends, hearing his, he was brought up by a military man, and how he knew from about the time he was 3 that he was different. And he couldn't tell his father, he couldn't tell his mother, he was in love with his best friend. He couldn't tell the church because he knew that he would be considered a sinner. And he just went through agony, man. I have seen him in the throes of agony when he cried and we put our arms around him and hug him. And then, of course, when I got to know the I already knew some of Lorraine's lesbian friends, but this way I was getting to know people in my church who were lesbian. And so it took a long time.
And your daughter?
Oh, we had a long period of estrangement. And we finally, she suggested, my husband and I, and go with her to a psychiatrist. And we went there for about a year and a half and talked things over. And now we're very, very close. We have a very close relationship. But it took a long time. I think people are there's a lot more accepting climate now. A lot of people are still very, very angry, very upset. I really haven't had a lot of angry conversations about it. Even in the Bible study group here, I have mentioned that, and there are some people that are a lot more conservative. But the way I've learned to look at it now from a scriptural point of view is the reason Jesus was so concerned with the scribes and Pharisees was because they were legalistic. They went by the letter of the law. And Jesus came to show us love, not living by legalism. His whole life was accepting people who were unacceptable to others. And so the way I look at it, the parts of the Bible that are cultural, some of them have been misinterpreted, they're legalistic concerns that would not concern Jesus' gospel of love. So that's the way, when I interpreted it that way to the Bible study group, I'm sure people disagree with me, but nobody said anything.
And we talked more about the retirement community and the classes she was taking and medical things and the 80th birthday party her daughters insisted she have. And then rather hesitantly, a vision at the age of 17.
I don't know whether you want to hear this or not. I had a very scary, I still can't talk about it, 17 years old. I had a very scary experience that really sort of ruined my senior year at high school. I had been to a service and our minister was there. He gave a talk on the words from Isaiah when Isaiah is touched on his lips with fire from the embers by the seraphim. And he says, "Who shall I send and who will go for me?" And Isaiah said, send me. Well, as I got ready to go to bed, we had a back porch that faced the backyard. And we always slept in the summer on the back porch because it was hot. And I looked out and I saw some long figures standing in the center of the sky. They didn't have wings. They didn't have faces. They didn't have feet. They just had long robes, white robes. And I was absolutely terrified. So my mother was in the bedroom next to me, and I called her. And she said, "Oh, Adele, must be the humidity and something the matter with the humidity and the light's on in the attic. Go turn off the light in the attic." So I turned off the light in the attic and it was still there. So that terrified me even more, the fact that she had seen it and it was still there. So all night long I tossed and turned and thought of scripture and hymns. But I never told my pastor about it because the only thing that I could think of was that I was supposed to be a missionary in China or India. And that, oh, I thought, oh no, I never want that. So then that whole year, I was tormented by the guilt. I even got so that when we would go to a movie theater, in those days you could hear the phone ring in the manager's office, and would ring, and I was sure my mother and father had been killed or something because of my guilt. And it went on for years and years and years. And then finally, when my husband and I were counselors of the youth group, one Sunday, it must have been 12 or 14 years afterwards, I shared it with them. So I had originally intended to be a social worker. I thought that that would be the way that I would demonstrate my love of equality and love of other people. But then I got pregnant sooner than I expected, and so that never came to fruition. And before my mother died, I asked her about that, and she still said, "Poppycock." She still didn't want to believe it had happened, but it happened. It sure did. It was scary, it really was.
Outside Washington, D.C., we were talking with Adele Hutchins.
So, another show. We just want to say that we have now been on the air 3 years.
Wow. Well, we'd like to thank, for starters, all the stations that have been with us from the top. Robin and Bruce and now Melissa at KRCB. Susan and now Erica at KPFA. Mary and Jamie at KZYX, and Lions at KWMR out in Point Reyes, and about 100 people who've contributed money.
And the Media Arts Panel at the National Endowment for the Arts, spending a few of your federal tax dollars on something that doesn't zip through the airwaves and explode. And our technical volunteers, Lou Judson and Colleen Burrows, Eli Bishop, Steve Powell and Steve Willite way back at the start, Irene and the web design team from Santa Rosa Junior College, our office assistant, Joan White, friends and staff of the Association for Independence in Radio for much generous advice, and the people, who have come forward with their stories either in interviews or giving us stories to dramatize, the dozen or so people who've helped to shape our audio dramas. We're talking about around 160 people.
Just 6 billion to go.
And our spinoff, The Hitchhiker's Cabaret Cauldron, if you're in the Bay Area, the final Friday of every month in Sebastopol. Another tribe of people making this happen. That's it. Thank you. www.hitching.org. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
Peace. And joy.
And the prime energy lives with us, you know. So when I do the music, it's generated by that. It's the connection, basically. I'm not doing it for myself. I'm not doing it, well, only going to please and living in it. I don't live in an ivory tower and write. I wrote my symphonies engaged with the members of the orchestra, seeing them, be with the people, and feel it. So whatever I do is engaged with people. Yeah, so that's the priming engagement, I think, yeah.